Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome back to another episode of the Damage Report, everybody. I am John Iadarola, flying solo for the most part, at least in studio today, although I will be joined by two awesome guests a little bit later on. In just about 15 minutes, I'm going to be joined by none other than Naomi Klein, the author of Shock Doctrine, No Is Not Enough, a number of other books that you're probably familiar with. I've loved her writing for a long time. She's going to be coming on the show, Skyping in to talk about the situation in Puerto Rico, the actual subject of her most recent book. We're going to be talking about disaster capitalism as applied to Puerto Rico, reactions to hurricanes, a number of other topics. It is going to be awesome. I can't wait. I've been wanting to have her on the show for a number of months. And later on, we're going to be joined by a very unique guest. So Sarah Jones, her show, it's a one-woman show, Sell By Date, is going to be in the studio to talk about her show. Now, her show, it's just her, but it's many characters, and she plays all of them. And it's an analysis of the present state and future of sex work from a number of different angles. And I'm expecting that we're going to have a lot of fun with that as well. I've got a lot of different topics I want to bring up with her. In terms of the news, though, you're going to be shocked to find out that we're going to be talking about Brett Kavanaugh for a little bit. There are some new updates on the likelihood of testimony actually happened. We have one new confirmed vote. Is it going to be in favor or opposed? We'll let you know that. And then there's something we didn't get to yesterday, and that is amidst this entire storm of defenses of Brett Kavanaugh, attacks against Christine Blasey Ford, one stands out as potentially the most disgusting and the most hypocritical. We're going to go over that and see if you agree. But there's much, much more. We have new updates on funding being taken away from one program to fund more camps at the border. You're going to be shocked at how brazen this misappropriation of funds has actually become. And then even more after that. One thing I can't wait. I hope that we have enough time near the end of the show to talk about this. We have a new argument from Donald Trump's legal team that says to me, that screams to me, that they are absolutely terrified about what's coming down the pike when it comes to obstruction of justice. Wait till you see how they try to rewrite history. But before that, obviously, we're going to be starting off with Kavanaugh. The Kavanaugh story is always one of many different facets. So buckle up. I hope that you've got your coffee ready. We're going to be going through them one at a time. I want to start, though, with that confirmed vote, because we've been wondering now. There's generally about 2 to 4 people on the Democratic side, 2 to 4 on the Republican side, where we don't actually know exactly how they're going to vote. And the future of the Brett Kavanaugh nomination is almost certainly going to come down to a small percentage of those uncertain votes. All the rest, we know exactly how they're going to vote. He could literally have sexually assaulted someone during his nomination hearing live on TV, and it wouldn't actually affect anything. There are only a few senators who could actually be swayed. One of them apparently has locked in their vote. That is Claire McCaskill. And I had a weird little, not a Freudian slip, more of a Freudian thought. When I saw the headline that she was actually going to vote against Brett Kavanaugh, I immediately processed it as, oh, this Republican is turning against him, which probably says a lot about her past voting record. But she is in fact a Democrat, and she is saying that she is not going to vote for him. But she also explains why she has decided not to support him, and we might have a little bit of a problem with that. Let's read a bit of that quote from Claire McCaskill, where she says, he has revealed his bias against limits on campaign donations, which places him completely out of the mainstream of this nation. He, meaning Brett Kavanaugh, wrote, and I have heard very few people say that limits on contributions to candidates are unconstitutional, although I, for one, tend to think those limits have some constitutional problems. She goes on to say, Judge Kavanaugh will give free rein to anonymous donors and foreign governments through their citizens to spend money to interfere and influence our elections with so-called issue ads. Now, on its face, if you're going to stand against a Supreme Court justice, that sounds great. Okay, she's actually taking the problem of money in politics seriously. She understands that it interacts with our political system and our elections in multiple ways, some of which are complex and not always talked about. So all of that sounds great. But after saying all of that, she then has to go on to say this. She says that the troubling allegation of sexual assault leveled against Kavanaugh did not influence her decision. Now, if that's true or if it's not true, we can interpret it in slightly different ways. It is possible, I guess, that she hasn't thought at all about it or doesn't think that it's credible enough, or it wasn't necessary. She came to this conclusion on Brett Kavanaugh without reference to the sexual assault allegations. I guess if that is the case, it bothers me because I think that you should be influenced by these things. And if you're not ready to make a decision based on what you know about the allegations as of this point, then at the very least push for an investigation that could unearth new facts, and then you could decide one way or the other. To sort of jump ahead of the process to say, I don't care about this, and I'm making clear to you that I wouldn't care about it even if I knew more, that does bother me. But I don't think that she's necessarily being honest. I think that it's likely that this is a defensive technique. Claire McCaskill, as a number of Democratic senators are worried about re-election in states where Donald Trump is still popular. And I think she is putting out the message, if you are a Trump supporter and you're riled up about issues like sexual assault claims, if you really hate this Me Too movement and what you see, you know, the change that's happening in society, don't worry, I'm not one of those people. Not to say that she doesn't support the actual victims here, but she wants to make clear that that's not changing her political behavior. And I have to admit that bothers me. Even though I like the stuff about the money in politics, I like that she's not going to be voting for him. That still leaves a number of other Democratic senators we're not sure about. Doug Jones has been supportive of Christine Blasey Ford coming forward and testifying. That doesn't mean that in the end he might not vote for him. And honestly, Claire McCaskill also voted against Gorsuch, so I guess it shouldn't really shock us. It was just the concern that possibly she would go the other way. A few other things I want to talk about, though. So the Republicans have been attempting to make clear at the same time that they're attacking Ford constantly, nonstop, in ever-evolving ways, devoid of any reference to facts. They still have an open mind, and that's why they want her to come and testify. If she comes in on Monday, they will hear what she says, they will hear what Brett Kavanaugh says, and then they'll decide what to do accordingly. That's what they want you to think anyway. But there's one man who is a little bit more clear about what he thought. His name is Mike Davis. He is not a name that you probably see in the news very often. He's the Judiciary Committee's chief counsel for nominations. And he actually heads up a team of lawyers that is working on this nomination process for Brett Kavanaugh and would be intimately involved in any investigation happening through the Judiciary Committee as well. He's sort of the equivalent of the FBI chief for this weird version of an investigation that we might end up having. So what he thinks about it is pretty important. And recently he made clear what he thought. He tweeted this. He says, I personally question Judge Kavanaugh under penalty of felony and 5 years of imprisonment if he lies. I'm still waiting to hear back from the accuser's attorneys who can't find time between TV appearances to get back to me. So that's a version of the they're in it for the attention argument. But that's not even what really bothers me about this guy's motivations. He then tweeted, unfazed and determined, we will confirm Judge Kavanaugh. Hashtag confirm Kavanaugh. Hashtag SCOTUS. So if he's not clear enough in that first message, he's clear in the second. No, he is going to get this thing through. This is before the testimony. This is before he's talked to her. This is before she's come in and answered questions. He's unfazed and determined. But he's also determined to maintain the narrative that I was talking about before, because after people saw these tweets and started talking about them on Twitter at the very least, if not on the mainstream media, his account was locked briefly. He deleted the tweets and came back and said that he deleted them because the left-wing media was misinterpreting what he said. Okay, well, I mean, it's pretty short. Unfazed and determined, we will confirm Judge Kavanaugh. Am I misinterpreting that? That seems pretty clear. There's not a lot of room for reading between the lines when the tweet is literally two lines, well, three if you count the hashtag SCOTUS. But this is supposed to be an open-minded process of discovery and fact-finding. If you like fiction, at the very least. Okay, there's more to it though than just that. There's a screenshot of the Washington Post. They have an opinion article from Kathleen Parker that says, is there a Kavanaugh doppelganger? This is one of their conservative columnists there for the Washington Post that now has a new theory that it's not that the sexual assault didn't happen. It's just that she's confused. Ford is confused about who it was. And just convinced herself at the time that a guy that looked like Brett Kavanaugh was the one that was trying to rape her.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
And that is supposed to make sense. And she says multiple times in an article that is the most likely explanation. It takes a really bizarre approach to the memories of these women, a lack of respect for their ability to remember what happened to them. The fact that she has been talking about this since at least 2012, the idea that she was confused then and has maintained this fiction ever since. She was there at a party with four people. This was not some huge crowd of strangers. She knew the people that were there. So this is a very odd approach. Kathleen Parker, by the way, also has a book about ghosts haunting a stable where kids go to ride horses. So maybe she's just a fan of the fictions. I don't know. Anyway, we do have more that we're going to get to on this, but we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, Naomi Klein is going to join us. We're going to be breaking down the current state of Puerto Rico, the vultures that are moving in to reshape its future, and what we can possibly do about it. Okay, I could not be more excited to welcome to the Damage Report our next guest, the author of books like most recently The Battle for Paradise, as well as Shock Doctrine, No Is Not Enough, and a number of other books that you're probably familiar with if you're watching this show. Author and social activist Naomi Klein joins the Damage Report now.
Hi.
I'm very excited to have you here, especially considering the context that we're in as a country, where we have been hit recently by another hurricane. We see Donald Trump going to the affected areas, deploying, you know, all of his social media weight to try to put across the idea that he is taking these sorts of disasters seriously. But we have not forgotten what happened last year with Puerto Rico and Hurricane Maria. This is something that you've written about extensively and gets into one of your main topics of writing, which is disaster capitalism. For people who might not be familiar with that term, what is that a reference to?
Right. So I started using the term disaster capitalism in 2004, and it was referencing the Asian tsunami that happened on Christmas Eve in 2004, which was a devastating natural disaster, but which was exploited, which was harnessed to grab land from fishing people, small plot farmers, and turn it into tourism resorts and things like that. And so disaster capitalism, where I sometimes use the term the shock doctrine, as you know, is this strategy of exploiting moments of profound crisis, of collective trauma. It could be a natural disaster. It could be a profound economic crisis. It could be a war, but a situation in which people are necessarily focused on their daily emergencies, the daily effort of staying alive, and using that dislocation and trauma to push through a wish list of pro-corporate policies and to profit in various ways from disaster.
Well, we've certainly got an example of that. I mean, what happened to Puerto Rico is just about as bad of a disaster as you can imagine, not just in terms of how they were hit by the hurricane, but the lack of interest on the part of the government, the lack of a willingness to do what's necessary to stop people from dying. They spent months without access to electricity and other basic services. So in your analysis of Puerto Rico and the attempted recovery from that last hurricane, are we seeing an influx of disaster capitalists?
Well, absolutely, we are. We are seeing this strategy unfold in real time now, where there was a pre-existing agenda to attack the public sphere in Puerto Rico, to radically shrink the public sector, that whether in education or healthcare, and the disaster has been used as the pretext to push through that agenda. But in Puerto Rico, you have a particularly severe case of this because the story really doesn't start with Hurricane Maria. It starts with the debt crisis that began to spiral out of control in the decade before Maria, right? So, but even before Maria, people were talking about Puerto Rico as this textbook example of the shock doctrine because the debt, which was not accumulated by ordinary Puerto Ricans, but was, you know, the fault of, you know, the laws that were put in place to turn Puerto Rico into tax haven, and also an economic crisis that was imposed on Puerto Rico by Washington when they allowed a series of tax breaks to expire. And there was capital flight where all of these factories closed and people lost a large number of jobs in Puerto Rico. So this really is starting in 2006. It started to get really bad. Then the worldwide economic crisis made it even worse. And then Puerto Rico tried to borrow its way out of it. A lot of the debt is considered to be illegal by many experts, but it, you know, reaches this absolutely unpayable sum of $77 billion by some counts and so on. So what's important to understand here is the way in which the debt was being exploited well before Maria to radically weaken the public sphere, right? So the reason why the storm had such a profound impact is not just because it was a record-breaking storm, but because Puerto Rico's public infrastructure was already so neglected and under attack when the storm hit. So on a good day, the electricity system wasn't functioning well in Puerto Rico, and the storm functioned as the last straw. So you have a lot of converging forces. You have a legacy of colonialism and an economy that is really built to be dependent. So you have this very fertile island that is importing 85% of its fuel and more than 85% of its food and more than 95% of its fuel, even though it could have 100% renewable energy just from the sun and the wind on the island. So it's built to be dependent. It's built to be a captive market. It's already in the midst of this brutal austerity program, and then Maria slams headlong into that. And then, as you said, the so-called recovery effort really reflected this same disdain for Puerto Ricans and for Puerto Rican institutions.
So I think that you've perfectly laid out what the possible recovery that's been set up for might look like. But there is at least one other potential path for recovery that's been advocated by politicians like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently, where she has been pushing for something akin to a Marshall Plan for Puerto Rico, to put it on the path not just for recovery, but for sustainability in terms of energy and environment and all of that. Do you think that some sort of sustained large-scale influx of money and aid from the government could help Puerto Rico? And if so, what form should that take to actually do what's necessary for the island?
Right. And I think that the bill that she is referring to, which was drafted, you know, by Bernie Sanders and Senator Warren as well, you know, it is one that comes actually from below. It comes from Puerto Ricans who have been organizing and demanding this type of response, right? And this is why it is so important to understand that this is not, you know, an act of God, a natural disaster. There's really nothing natural about the extent of the catastrophe in Puerto Rico. You have all these unnatural forces that I was just describing, right, of the way in which the public sphere suffered from this program of economic punishment that made it so much more vulnerable. But even the storm itself can't just be called a natural disaster anymore, any more than any of the storms that we're seeing now, like Florence or last year with Irma or Harvey. You know, what climate scientists are telling us is that every storm now is being supercharged by climate change, because the storms are coming from an ocean that is warmer and sea levels are higher. So every storm is an abnormal storm now. And so that's not natural either. That's not God that did it. It's governments at the behest of the fossil fuel companies that pay for their campaigns. So we need to understand the forces that created this catastrophe, because it should inform our response, right? So we have the Trump administration that just wants more of the same, right? More fossil fuel pollution, more disaster capitalism. But I think what's compelling about that Green New Deal or that Marshall Plan, that Green Marshall Plan for Puerto Rico, is that it is about learning from this catastrophe and coming up with a recovery, a justice-based recovery that actually gets at the underlying causes, that cuts pollution, that moves Puerto Rico to renewable energy, but also invests in the public sphere that has been so neglected, as opposed to the plan that's actually on the table, which is to sell off the electricity grid to the highest bidder.
You know, I'm glad that you brought up justice there, because we know from endless examples that although disasters can happen anywhere, technically, they certainly seem to hit certain areas harder, and the recovery certainly seems to be less of a focus when it's a certain type of person along a few different lines of demographics. And there, obviously, I'm referring to both class and race. You've talked about disaster capitalism in many different parts of the world, different examples. Is that a big part of this, exploiting certain types of communities? Or when it comes to disaster capitalists, are they pretty much, they'll go anywhere where the money takes them?
I don't think it is by any means a coincidence that the communities that have seen the heaviest dose, of this kind of profiteering and really trauma exploitation are places that are majority people of color, whether we're talking about Puerto Rico or whether we're talking about New Orleans in the aftermath of Katrina, where, as I wrote about in the Shock Doctrine, Republican state congressperson in Louisiana famously said, we couldn't clean out the public housing projects, but God did, right? As if this was a gift from God to be able to bulldoze the public housing and replace it with condominiums. It is not by accident that this happens in majority black and brown cities and islands. But I also think it's important not to romanticize what is happening right now in North Carolina, or what's happening, what happened in Texas. I mean, that all was not rosy there. And we're hearing horror stories about the treatment of inmates, where you have essentially slave labor helping to prepare for these storms, filling sandbags to prepare communities and then not evacuating prisoners. There was a horrifying report just in the last couple of days of two mentally ill women who were chained in the back of a van that took on water, and they drowned while the officers who were transporting them in chains were rescued. So I think what we're seeing is that what these mega disasters do is they exacerbate pre-existing inequalities. And in Puerto Rico, you had huge inequalities because it is a colony. So in the inequalities between the relationship with mainland United States. And so all of that has been exacerbated. But even within the disasters happening, whether it's wildfires in California or floods in the Carolinas, we are seeing the same impact.
Well, Naomi Klein, author of The Battle for Paradise, as well as many other incredibly important and necessary books, thank you for joining us and helping update us on what's going on in Puerto Rico.
My pleasure. Great to talk with you.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little bit more on Brett Kavanaugh, and as I alluded to in the beginning, possibly the worst set of attacks against Christine Blasey Ford that I've seen so far, after this. Welcome back to the Damage Report, everybody. We unfortunately have way too much show that we're going to try to fit into way too little time. So let's jump back to Brett Kavanaugh, where I have a couple other points that I want to make. One is that Brett Kavanaugh found himself with a new defender this morning, Roy Moore, who you might remember from his multiple accusations of having tried to seduce underage girls. So I guess it would be unfair to say that he's not an expert in this area, but not much of a character witness necessarily. It sounds like something out of The Onion, but no, Roy Moore is speaking up today saying that Senate Republicans need to do what's right and stand up for Brett Kavanaugh. And I'm sure even Chuck Grassley, as black and crusted over a heart as any in the world, is probably saying, no, go away. We don't need you right now. But that's who they have. They have Roy Moore, people like that. And one that we'll get to in just a little bit. I did want to just remind you of something in case you didn't watch yesterday's program. One thing that I was hoping to see more talk of in the mainstream media as a result of the awesome exclusive reporting of TYT Investigates, but as of right now has not been picked up. And that is the incredibly suspicious actions of Brett Kavanaugh when he decided to take a speech that he gave in 2015, where he said the awesome phrase, "What happens at Georgetown Prep stays at Georgetown Prep," and redact that part of the transcript that he sent to the Senate. And to be fair, that's not even accurate. He didn't even redact it. That implies that something was taken out. He just pretended that he didn't say that incredibly creepy and concerning phrase. So he took it out. That's really weird, and nobody seems to be talking about it. They keep saying that his character has never been impugned except for this action that took place 36 years ago. And yet that seems weird. And then we also find out that one of the people working over him advised, I believe it was interns that would be working with him as a judge, that he likes his interns to look a certain way, the females. That's odd. And that person who warned the intern of that likes him and defends his character, but still understands that he's a man who wants his female law interns to look a particular way. But again, he's only ever had his character or reputation impugned one time. Also, I noticed, and this is just because I've been following so closely what Jonathan Larson and TOT Investigates have been doing, their new update on this story today is that two Georgetown Prep classmates of Brett Kavanaugh were the ones who spearheaded an alumni letter attesting to his character. Those two individuals were two of the guys that he named in that section of the speech that he took out when he gave it to the Senate, where he said, "What happens at Georgetown Prep stays at Georgetown Prep." Is it possible that those individuals know something? Maybe they're worried, but not just about Brett Kavanaugh, maybe a little bit worried about themselves and what could possibly come out if there's an investigation, have a little bit of a vested interest in tamping this thing down as quickly as possible. I don't think that that's crazy. So again, hopefully people will pick this up and start talking about it, because it is a very important part of the conversation. But I want to jump now to Dennis Prager. This is a conservative radio host. He wrote an article for the National Review a couple of days ago in defense of Brett Kavanaugh, and he said a few insane things. First of all, he said that the left-wing concern about this sexual assault represents nihilism. That if we are to judge a man for an attempted rape that he did several decades ago, there's no longer any values in society. This is the conservative Christian-y guy, says that concerns about rape represent nihilism. I would say that following a religion that tells you to be most concerned about these sorts of things and then selectively not caring when it's to your political and judicial advantage, there's some nihilism for you. But what do I know? I'm not being paid billions of dollars to produce videos. So let's talk a little bit more about his defense of Brett Kavanaugh. He said that these actions tell us nothing about Brett Kavanaugh since the age of 17. Okay, that's an interesting thing. I'll reiterate what I said a few days ago. If you are continuing to lie now about an attempted rape you did decades ago, that tells us plenty about you, and not just from decades ago. It says something about your character now, that you are so eager to get this position that you are willing to call a woman who has suffered an attempted rape a liar to help destroy her credibility when she is being faced with death threats, when she's being run out of her home, and you sit by just smugly asserting that she's been lying about the entire thing. I don't think that says nothing about your character. I think that says everything about your character. He also says, this is another example of the moral chaos sown by secularism and the left. In any society rooted in Judeo-Christian values, it's understood that people should be morally assessed based on how they behave over the course of their lifetime. Early behavior being the least important period in making such an assessment. I mean, I would love to go back through the collected works of Dennis Prager and see how he talks about other teenagers who've been convicted or accused of crimes, and see if maybe there's a few demographic reasons why certain people should be judged by what they did as teenagers, and others should be given a pass, especially if they go on to become conservative jurists. I have a feeling that's probably the case. But he says that this is an example of moral chaos. No, again, if you believe that you have a divinely inspired workbook for everything that is true and right in the universe, but hey, this guy's a conservative, so let's let him get away with an attempted rape, that's moral chaos. Holding everyone to the same standard, saying that sexual assault and sexual harassment are wrong, whether they happened yesterday or 36 years ago, that's not chaos, that's consistency. That's quite strong from the standpoint of strength, as Donald Trump might say. He also said this, and this is what he thinks female empowerment looks like. He said, when my wife was a waitress in her mid-teens, the manager of a restaurant grabbed her breasts and squeezed them on numerous occasions. She told him to buzz off, figured out how to avoid being in places where they were alone, and continued going about her job. That's empowerment. I will take his depiction of what happened as the case and say that I am glad that his wife was willing to deal with this absolutely horrible situation in probably the only way that she was allowed, knowing that if she were to accuse her manager of doing these sorts of things, people like Dennis Prager would call her a liar and destroy her credibility. In that circumstance, yes, this is how you have to be empowered. But we want to produce a society where you don't have to do that, where people who are routinely grabbing the breasts of their employees actually suffer some sort of consequences beyond being told to buzz off. But again, I'm not the moral arbiter of what goes on in this country. It's people like Dennis Prager who are paid very well to do that sort of thing. Anyway, this is yet another of Brett Kavanaugh's defenders, if you can call what I just read an actual defense. With that said, we are going to take a break. When we come back, Sarah Jones is going to be joining us. I am hoping to learn a lot about the current and future state of sex work through the lens of a one-woman show after this. Welcome back to The Damage Report, everybody. I am John Arola, but I'm not alone now in studio. Sarah Jones, very glad to have you here.
You're not alone, John.
So you are a writer, performer, sort of combination actress, host in a one-woman show, which had a very successful run and is now coming back in LA for another run. This is Sell By Date. I think we have an image that will help get across a little bit of what that show is about. This is an analysis of a number of different areas of society having to do with different aspects of sex work through the lens of a number of different characters, all of whom you perform.
Right.
How does that work in practice?
Yeah, so the crazy thing is it is about, you know, it's about women and sex and power, but it's really about all of us, which I think, you know, TYT, like, you know, everything you all do kind of is connected for me around, you know, this political moment we're living in. You can't talk about women and sex without talking about Trump. You can't talk about, you know, the Supreme Court without talking about sexual assault. I mean, this is the moment we're in, right? So the show is really kind of about everything.
Yeah.
And I play lots of different characters from different backgrounds. And this show, I have such a great time with the audience. So I'm really excited to get to share it with more Angelenos.
Yeah.
This time around, yeah.
So obviously with something like this, I mean, part of it is going to be, I assume the goal is entertainment. People want to have a fun time.
If I'm going to drag you to the theater, you better have a good time. So yes, we're going to have a good time.
But is that the only objective?
I think, you know, like life, we have no choice but to face these difficult things that are going on. But if we don't have some kind of sense of humor, we're not going to make it. So I think, you know, the goal is, for example, there's a lot of different characters in the show. I play 19 altogether. And they range, I know it's a lot. It's a lot. I take a lot of vitamins. But they, you know, they range from, like, it's not necessarily who you would think you're going to see in a show about sex work, right? Or prostitution or whatever. So,
hi there, John. I just wanted to pop in and say hello. I can't resist. I'm sorry, but you know,
I don't think we've met.
My name is Lorraine Levine.
Very glad to have you in
the
studio.
You're not going to break my bones with that handshake. Anyway, Sarah Jones puts us in her show, what she calls her one-woman show. And you know what that means. I mean, she takes the credit and makes us come out and do all the work. But anyway, the show is entertaining. It's lively. And I'm in it. I like to think of myself as the star. But we also, you know, there's a lot of other people, and we all want to talk about what's happening right now. So that's what people will see if they come to the theater.
Wow. So look, I've read a number of reviews of your show, and they say that you nail all of the, you go smoothly from one to the other to the other. And I mean, obviously through body language and all of that. I'm gonna ask you a crazy question.
I can take it.
Just because I don't act. My girlfriend's an actress. I don't understand how any of it works. So you've been playing these characters, as you say, 19 characters
19
for quite some time.
In this show, there are more, believe it or not.
Are they starting to affect you?
Are you kidding me? So part of me thinks this is just free therapy. Like there's a part of me that's like, you know, God willing, if we still have healthcare, I will, you know, still be like the way we all, you know, have to interact in a culture where there's so much polarization. This is my way of reminding myself I'm no different than anybody else, no matter how I look. I may be young compared to that older woman I was just doing, but I actually come from a multicultural family, and I feel like my family is a microcosm of the rest of the country and the way we could live. You know, we don't all have to come from the same background to get along as, you know, like sane human beings. So I think that's where my characters come from, is like my family, my neighbors, and the multicultural moment that we're all living in.
So I'm going to this interview hoping to learn something. So I want to talk about beyond the show, obviously, there's the themes of the show, which have to do with sex work. work in multiple different areas, how people think about it. And it certainly feels like for all of the social change I keep hearing about, conservatives are terrified that everything's changing so fast. Some things don't seem to be. And it still seems like when it comes to sex work in all of its many different forms, there is an incredible amount of stigma remaining.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Is that changing over time? Are shows like yours helpful in helping to remove some of the stigma about even talking about sex work?
Well, it's funny because even the language that we use, right? It's like the show, I was really fortunate to interview people from all around the world. And I've had incredible mentors, you know, actors. Meryl Streep is one of my mentors.
Oh, wow.
Lily Tomlin is actually one of the co-hosts of our opening, you know, event.
And you're at her theater.
And I'm at a theater that's named for her. At the Renberg Theater, but it's part of the Lily Tomlin and Jane Wagner Cultural Center. But the reason I mention all those people is the imagery that we've seen in Hollywood, right? It's either the happy hooker or it's, you know, this downtrodden, like it's always there are these one-dimensional portrayals that don't give the women credit for who they are. And it could be, you know, the girl next door, quote unquote. Like I want us to humanize the women who are sometimes caught up in an industry they don't want to be in. Many people call it prostitution as opposed to sex work. So I try to get in there and look at all the different angles. Is it exploitation? Is it empowerment for some people? You know, who's looking at it and how? And none of us are as removed from this as we think. Hello, Stormy Daniels. You know, every time you turn on the news, there's some proximity to the sex industry. So I want us to have that conversation in a more sincere way.
Yeah, and I noticed even I talked so a former adult film star, Aurora Snow, has been on the show. And we were talking about that a while back about when Stormy Daniels was in the news even more than she is now. And she still is. The attacks against her, not just necessarily attacks, but sort of like snide remarks, were not just coming from the right. Like it was a very funny thing for a lot
of
people across the spectrum. And that's stigma can come in a lot of different forms. It can come from a desire not to talk at all, but can also be how you talk about it.
Yeah, I think judgment and, you know, I mean, misogyny has a lot of, you know, unfortunate guises, but one of them is the ways we punish women for everything. You're damned if you do. You're damned if you don't. You're just damned.
Mm-hmm.
And
no, you're not damned. You cut it off there. I think we're fine.
You're darned. you're darned if you do. But you know, I think the goal is to talk about how people want to hide from, you know, our normal human sexuality. And one way we do that is by punishing women, you know, who are often just trying to earn a living or they've been victims themselves. I learned in doing my research, the average age of a girl first being introduced to sex work or the sex industry is 12 or 13.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it's sobering. And I think it's important for us to look at how we label women, judge women, and punish women, you know, for... Well, hopefully people will come see the show and see the different angles of how I want to look at it.
So we talked before we went live about how the show has been changing over time.
Yeah.
But I'm interested, the industry that you're talking about obviously is changing as well with different forms of technology, obviously like cam girls and things like that. This is something that wasn't possible 20 or 30 years ago. Do you think that these technological changes, the websites where there's like, you know, there's sugar daddy websites and things like that. Is this helping in general or is this just changing?
You know, it's so interesting. In the different characters in the show, who are so happy to be here and huge TYT fans, I'll let one of them.
Hi, so my name is Bella. I'm super stoked to be here right now. Hi, John.
Hey, Bella.
I met Sarah Jones because I'm a feminist, but I'm like a sex positive feminist. Like, I don't want people like telling me what I can and cannot do with like my body. In fact, like I co-host like, I don't really want to invite like, you know, toxic masculinity into this space, but like, you know, there's a like strippers event that I host on Wednesdays on my campus that's like feminist stripping. It's called Don't Get All Pole Emical. But, you know, like the point is we should get to decide like what we want to do. And the industry is changing, technology is changing, but the one thing that's not changing is like people wanting to shame women. And we want to talk about healthy sex for like everyone so that we don't feel so restriculous, which is like a word that I made that means so strict, it's ridiculous.
And you're empowered to make up words if you want to.
She appreciates that.
I have one other question for you. So you talk there about wanting, you know, this for everybody. So I'm imagining, especially in LA, a lot of the people that watch your show are going to be libs of one form or another.
We got some libs.
But you've been doing this show for some time. What has the reaction been from conservatives that have watched?
So I've gotten people, I've been surprised at not just the range politically, but also this has really been unique for me gender-wise. Mm-hmm. Men who are like, is this like a chick show? You know, is it like their girlfriend drags them to the show? And then they say, oh my God, I've never thought about this way. Like, I had no idea what I was stepping into, and I actually feel like I'm moved, and, you know, I play men in the show. My goal is not to attack anybody. It's to have, like, a more interesting conversation that invites all of us to the table, so.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
And you know what? I'm gonna flip it. I'm gonna drag my girlfriend to your show.
Oh my God, I love it!
Which is starting the preview is September 27th.
Yeah, okay. And so I'll see you in 7 days, T-minus 7 days, at the Renberg Theater in Hollywood.
Well, thank you very much. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you, John. My
pleasure.
Sounds
like an awesome show.
Our pleasure.
There you go. 19 pleasures. Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, something so important that I want to fit in for the rest of the show. Welcome back to the show, everybody. We have almost no time, but here is what I want to talk about. The fears of Donald Trump and his legal team as expressed by their legal strategy. This is not something that I'm really inferring too much into their behavior. They're being very clear about it, how worried they are about what might come out of this Mueller investigation. And here I'm mostly talking about the possibility of charges having to do with obstruction of justice, something that I have believed will be a relatively easy case to make, considering the many times that completely publicly Donald Trump has obviously obstructed justice in this case. But there's one area going back more than a year, close to a year and a half at this point, that they're definitely worried about. And that is his interview with Lester Holt, Donald Trump, when he said that while thinking about firing James Comey, he was thinking about this Russia thing and how it was fake and it was an excuse. That seems concerning if you're firing the head of the FBI because you're worried about this Russia thing and what it might mean. Now, obviously for Donald Trump, that's something to be worried about, that Mueller knows about this, is investigating it, that could be a big part of future obstruction of justice charges. So they have decided that they are simply going to rewrite history. Donald Trump has previously said that Lester Holt fudged the interview. I don't know what that means. But now Jay Sekulow was on with, I think it was with Chris Cuomo, and here is their new line of argument.
And as you know, because you do TV and do a good job.
Thank you.
You know that when there are interviews, there are edits, and there is a longer transcript. And I will just tell you, without disclosing any detail, that when you review the entire transcript, it is very clear as to what happened. And I'm not going to give you information on how we provided it, but in our professional discussions with the Office of Special Counsel, we've addressed that on multiple occasions appropriately. And the evidence, when you look at the entire evidence, and you don't see it. And I'm not, by the way, I'm not faulting anybody for running a clip or this. But to turn that into literally a federal case, we don't think is right. We don't think it's constitutional. And we think the entire transcript, without question, supports that the president realized that when he fired James Comey, it might actually extend this investigation. And he said that on the tape.
Look.
Oh, that's amazing. We don't think it's right. We don't think it's constitutional to say that that might have been obstruction of justice. I don't even know what that means. And I'm not going to find out because Jay Sekulow makes clear many times in the course of just that one little clip, we're not going to give you information. We're not going to give you specifics. We're not going to say how we got this. We're not going to say what we said. But we said to the Mueller team that we don't think that there's anything to this obstruction of justice thing. It is possible that they were more convincing in their private talks with the Mueller investigators than he was right there with Chris Cuomo. I sort of doubt it, but it is possible. So what do they mean there? What are they trying to assert? Now, in the simplest form, what they're saying is that the interview was edited. It was fudged, or he said there, you know, you do interviews, there are edits. It seems that what they're trying to say is that the clip was not actually, the initial clip of Donald Trump saying he was thinking about this Russia thing is not actually how it went down. Now, it turns out their argument is a little bit more, I guess, complex than that, but not much. So here's what they're trying to say is that later on in the interview, Trump said something that directly abuts what he had said earlier. And that is this. Trump said, as far as I'm concerned, I want that thing, the Russia investigation, to be absolutely done properly. When I did this now, I said I probably maybe will confuse people. Maybe I'll expand that, you know, I'll lengthen the time because it should be over with. It should, in my opinion, should have been over with a long time ago because it all is an excuse. But I said to myself, I might even lengthen out the investigation. But I have to do the right thing for the American people. He's the wrong man for that position. So somehow that is the argument for why Donald Trump was not admitting that Russia made him fire James Comey. That he said that hypothetically firing Comey might make the investigation take longer is proof that he was not attempting to obstruct the ongoing investigation. That makes no sense whatsoever. And that is why Jay Sekulow doesn't make clear that that is what they have actually been arguing behind the scenes, both with the media and with the Mueller investigators. They want Mueller to think there's something to the rest of the transcript, but they want to make it very clear to people casually watching this that it's not about that actual argument. It's about fudging. It's about phantom edits. Because they know that their audience, their fans, are conspiracy theory buyers. And if you say the media just cut the video in a way that's confusing, forget the fact that this full transcript has been available for more than a year. The full video has been available for more than a year. The damn fake news is lying to you. So don't look any deeper. It's just a phantom edit. That's all it is. Donald Trump is innocent. Everything is right with the world. That is what Donald Trump's legal team is doing. And they're doing it because they are terrified of what's to come. Okay, I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a fun show. Thank you for watching. Tomorrow morning, much, much more for you. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.